good to see all of you here today. And also I'd like to extend greetings to the brethren in Australia who are attending the Friends of the Sabbath Conference. I have been asked to speak about the Sabbatarians in Ukraine, and not being able to come to Australia myself, I thought that I would make this presentation and explain some of the history and the experiences that we have shared together. I personally have been involved with the Sabbatarians now for 5 years. In fact, my first meeting with the Sabbatarians was in the United States in June of 1991. So that's almost 5 years, or by the time this tape is played in July, it'll be over 5 years. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the relationships that we've had. It's been 5 years now, and we can take a look at a perspective of what it's involved and the relationship that we have and how we look to relate together for the future. The meeting was a rather chance meeting. A minister called me from Port St. Lucie, from the Melbourne Port St. Lucie church circuit, in May of 1991. At that time, I was the assistant director of church administration, and he told me about a group of Sabbatarians that had immigrated to the United States in November of 1990. They came over under the auspices of the Helsinki Human Rights Accord, which guaranteed religious immigration or freedom and first immigration rights to those who were persecuted for religious reasons. It had to have been a group that was not one of the mainstream religions, but a group that had been persecuted over the past number of years under the communist system. A group of 14 people came over. Among them was Michael Palche. At that time, he was just 80 years old, and he came with his extended family. Michael Palche was the leader of the Sabbatarians. He was responsible for about 3,000 people and 32 churches. He'd come to the point in his life where he felt that his work was at an end. He was well-loved, highly respected, and on every visit that I have taken to Ukraine, people have wept by the mention of his name. He was one who did so much for promoting faith in Transcarpathia. Michael Palche felt that his work was over and that he had an opportunity to have some of his family be able to start a new life. So he came over with three of his daughters and their husbands and their children. They came over in the fall of 1991. As they were getting settled, a lady who was helping them with translation and helping them with housing and getting settled was a former prospective member of the Worldwide Church of God. And these people asked her if she knew where there was a Sabbatarian church. And of course she knew, because she was already in contact with the ministry at that time. The local church was only a mile or two from their home. And so they called the pastor, who visited them, and invited the whole group of 14. At that time, one of them had died, the wife of Michael Palche. So the entire group of 13 started attending church services in Port St. Lucie. I came to visit them shortly after Pentecost in 1991 on a church visit. It was a most interesting visit. I was with my wife, Beverly. These people met us with prayer. Immediately we had things in common. Of course, what brought us commonly together was not only the fact that we had many similar beliefs, but the fact that we could speak the same language. That really helps. In talking to Michael Palche and to his daughters, I found out that we had a number of things in common. First and foremost, we had a deep and abiding love and worship of Jesus Christ. We had a high respect for the law of God, for the Sabbath. We both observed clean, unclean meats, the laws of the Levitical laws, of clean meat. We both kept the Passover and conducted the foot washing service. We both had the same view of the nature of God. We were not Trinitarian. We had the same perspective on what is eternal life and what death is, and that at death all consciousness ceases. Neither of us observed the Roman holidays of Christmas, of Easter. We did not use the cross. I was very open with them and asked them why they did some of the things that they did. For example, I asked them why didn't they observe Christmas and Easter and the remainder of the Roman holidays. They were very openly said it's because they came from paganism. I mean, they had no trouble understanding what the roots of those holidays were. When we talked about the nature of God, and it was not at that point, they very clearly spelled out their perspective of how they viewed what the Bible had to say on the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. What is the history of these people? People oftentimes ask about the continuity of the church from the days of the apostles, and perhaps it came through these people in a way that was a succession from one group to another. But it was not so with this group. Here, in a nutshell, is the brief history of the Sabbatarians in Transcarpathia today and that entire movement. Now, first of all, there have been Sabbatarians more in that area of the world than almost any other place. In the mountainous areas of Transcarpathia and in Transylvania, there has been a history of those who worshipped God on the Sabbath day. But this was a very large movement that has now about 10,000 followers, in 3,000 in Transcarpathia, which is in Ukraine, 4,000 across the border in Romania, and they say another 3,000 or so in Moldova. So there are at least 10,000 people who are Sabbatarians. They don't even know fully all the totality of the number of people who observe the Sabbath. But how did it begin? Well, in 1948, a man by the name of Philip lived 35 kilometers away from Rokossova. That's the village that Michael Palche lived in. Michael Palche was a Baptist minister. Now, he's the one who's the Sabbatarian now. This man, Philip, walked in his willow shoes. People were in poverty then, and they made shoes out of willow branches. It's like wooden shoes. And he came to Michael Palche's home. And he told Michael that it had been prophesied that the Sabbath should be observed, along with the Levitical food laws. Michael Palche told Philip that if he had walked 100 times over to his house with that message, he would never keep the Sabbath. They prayed for the Holy Spirit to come upon that church. And Pentecost of 1949, the next year, they began to understand that they should be keeping the Sabbath and they should be observing the Levitical food laws, among other beliefs. Soon after that time, Michael Palche was converted to Sabbath keeping. People in the village who were members of his church gave away their pigs. Some sold them, but if they couldn't sell them, they gave them away. And 32 churches were established in the county, the oblast. And that oblast is Zakarpattia or Transcarpathia. And soon other non-Baptist villagers became part of the Sabbath keepers, to the point of where in Transcarpathia it had become the third largest denomination. The largest two were the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. The Sabbatarians were the third largest. Now, in the village of Rokossova, there are about 200 members, 200 people who attend weekly Sabbath services. It's always been a joy when my wife and I have visited, when we stayed at the home of the leading lay member, Ivan Pavli, who we have gotten to love very dearly, he and his wife, to see on the way to Sabbath services people coming from homes everywhere, all walking down a couple of different streets, all heading to the house of prayer, to the building that they have built. As they all come to keep the Sabbath day. Their history has not been a smooth and easy one. 1948 was just after World War II. The USSR had just lost millions of people in World War II. Stalin was in power and was as brutal as he had ever been, and especially brutal towards those who practiced any kind of religion, although it was easier to practice your faith in a remote area like Transcarpathia than it was in the larger cities. And I'm sure it's for this reason that Sabbatarianism has flourished in the Carpathian Mountains. But they've gone through a great deal of persecution for their beliefs. They have obeyed God where there have been no civil freedoms. In fact, meetings were forbidden. If a meeting was held in your home could be confiscated, and the police were always looking out for those who were holding meetings. And yet these people always observed the Sabbath. Sometimes when things got so bad, they met in the winter time, in the middle of the night, Friday night, in deep snow, in the woods, to praise God, to sing, and to worship Him. It was an amazing faith, amazing fortitude of these people to do what they felt they had to do. Now, since meetings, religious meetings, were forbidden, they had to find other ways to meet. And one type of meeting that was not forbidden was a wedding. And they said that when anyone got married, there were at least 1,500 people who would come to the wedding. The Sabbatarians would all get together because that was their opportunity to fellowship. And they would stay for a whole week as they would see each other. We had the honor 2 years ago in April to attend a wedding where there were only 300 to 400 people. It was quite a number for that village. Yet they said that's nothing like the weddings that we had back when meetings were forbidden, when the entire village would be overcome by Sabbatarians coming from all over Transcarpathia for a wedding to people that they had not known. Of course, being a minister was forbidden. You could be put into prison if you were in any way representing yourself as a minister. In fact, for a while, owning a Bible could put you into prison for 5 years. And so people put plain covers on their Bibles. They printed their own songbooks in basements and moved the pages from house to house as they put them together and bound them. And they showed us some of the songbooks that they had assembled. It just shows that when you want to do something and when you're committed to something, you will do it. And that's what I found among the Sabbatarians. We live in a country, we live in the West, where we have all kinds of freedoms to do what we please, where our rights are protected. It was interesting to see what kind of work God can do when the people have no rights and where the civil liberties are not protected and when they can be put into prison for what they believed. Some ministers were sent to Siberia to work, including Michael Palche. Because he was a leader, he was sent for 10 years. He only served a partial amount of that sentence because after the death of Stalin, there was amnesty given to people who were sent to the forests in Siberia to cut wood. The livelihood and future of the Sabbatarians' children was limited because of the Sabbath. They would not send their children to school on the Sabbath, and oftentimes some schools held classes on Saturdays, sometimes a half a day. They refused to send their children. They refused to have their children wear the insignia of the communists, the little pictures of Lenin, the three-cornered red handkerchiefs representing the young pioneers. They resisted this in a totally totalitarian and probably the most ruthless system against religion in our century. But in all of this, they not only survived, but they thrived. And their faith was infectious, and their numbers never wavered. In fact, they were doing as well under communism as they are today. Although, when we visited the church at Hoost, from the time that we went there the first time in 1992 to the present, that church has tripled in size. In Hoost, the church was 25 when we first went there, and when I was there for Sabbath services a month ago,
or maybe it was only 3 weeks ago, 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago, we had 75 in attendance. Nothing daunted their faith and trust in God to deliver them. And whenever we talked with them, one of the favorite items of discussion is what God has done for them in their life. How God has delivered them, how God protected them, how the police would come knocking on the door, but then they would walk away for no reason. Or stories about how the police would round people up, and then they would become confused and would let them all go. They talk about how God would deliver them time after time after time. Very inspiring stories about people that went through persecution. We sometimes talk to ourselves about what we would do under such conditions, or that there will be a time of persecution coming. To these people, that is past tense. That is something they have already gone through. They've already had to test and to prove their faith. They certainly had trouble as far as entering the army, for example. I would ask them, how in the world did you get out of being admitted into the Soviet army? The young men would tell me the stories about how they would enter, but then they would not bear arms, and how that would be honored, and how God would deliver them as well. The children of the Sabbatarians were often relegated to a life of a non-professional type of work. Most of the time it was working in construction and in agriculture, because they would not be and could not be admitted to higher institutions of learning, such as universities. Sabbatarians have said, now that we have religious freedom, we no longer are persecuted by the government. But we have new persecutors. He said, the Orthodox, the Catholic Church, has been persecuting us now. Michael Palche, in our first visits, urged me, and very strongly urged me, to go to Transcarpathia and visit these people. He felt he had a mission himself to come to the United States as his final act, as his final deed in his life, to tell the story of the Sabbatarians and to connect the believers on this side with those on that side of the ocean. And during the year of 1991-92, I had planned on four different occasions to go over, but was thwarted. The very first time was when actually a faculty member and I were going in August of 1991, and that month Gorbachev was deposed from power. A coup had taken place, and we felt that that's not a good time to travel to the USSR. Then after the Feast of Tabernacles, I was planning again to go, and events occurred that kept us from going. In the spring of 1992, my wife and I planned to go, but her mother was ill and eventually died that spring, and so we weren't able to go at that time. And then in the summer, we planned to go again, being part of a summer youth tour of YLU, but that also fell through because conditions were such in the Soviet Union, they were so unstable that we felt it was not a good year to send students. But finally, after more urging by Michael Palche, I decided that in the fall of 1992, I will go and visit. And so with me, I asked John Carlson, who was the German regional director, to accompany me, and we both left from Germany and went to Ukraine. Visiting Transcarpathia, while it's close to Europe, is a very difficult place to go to. We only had train schedules that took us to the last town in Hungary, the town of Záhony. And from there we had to pretty much feel our way through. Now in preparation for this first visit to Ukraine, we had taken with us an entire suitcase full of Bibles. We took some Russian Bibles, but mostly Ukrainian Bibles. And believe me, they are heavy. We took with us literature that we had. We took with us our magazines that showed us who we are as an organization. We took with us as many things as we possibly could. First of all, I flew to Zurich and met with some of the family of the Sabbatarians that had migrated from Ukraine and had lived in southern Germany. about an hour's drive from Zurich. And then at that point, I met John Carlson, and we took the train from Zurich to Vienna, to Budapest, and to Zahone. When we got to Zahone, which is at the border of Hungary and Ukraine, we saw that the only train that was going on through had just left, and that it would be nearly 24 hours before the next train would cross the border to Ukraine. We found that Zahone was not a city geared for tourists. There were no taxis, there were no hotels in the vicinity of the train station. Very few people spoke English, and I wondered if there was another way to cross the border. And people motioned me that there was. Just a little ways down the road, there was a crossing for automobiles. Well, we had all of our luggage with us, and I just told John Carlson, why don't you wait with our luggage here at the train station? I'll walk over and see what's involved with crossing the border down the road. I walked, it's almost 2 miles, before I saw ahead of me a line of cars that stretched for miles. Now, somebody at the train station recommended that we just ask somebody to get out of line, to come to the train station to pick us up and go back in line. Well, believe me, nobody wanted to do that. Some of the people had waited in their cars for 2-3 days to cross the border. They weren't about to leave the line. So I thought, well, I'll just walk back. We'll take our things and we'll do the best we can to get to the border ourselves. And we'll walk across. We had all of our luggage. It was extremely heavy. Nobody offered a ride. People passed us on the road. I was even hitchhiking. I had my thumb out, asking for somebody to pick me up. One person shook his fist at me. Nobody would pick us up. Our luggage was so voluminous that we had to carry some of it forward 50 feet or so, come back, pick up more luggage, and leapfrog our way for 2 miles. We finally got to the line of cars. It took a long time. Probably took an hour and a half to go that 2 miles. And we stood in line with the cars. It was very odd standing in line with a line of cars. It was like standing in a drive-through bank or at McDonald's drive-through window without a car, on foot. A person behind us got out and said to us, "You're foolish, you fools. You can't cross the border here without a car. You need a car to cross the border. They won't let you across on foot." Here we are standing with our Bibles, our suitcases, as Laurel and Hardy, almost feeling like Laurel and Hardy. But the man in the car ahead of us motioned to us and said, "I will take you across the border." Now, almost every car that was crossing the border at that point was loaded to the hilt with goods from the West. Some cars had 4 tires stacked on top of the car. They're bringing all they could. The car ahead of us was empty, except for the driver. His name was Romas Krunka. He was a Lithuanian, and he was crossing the border after visiting friends in Hungary and going back home to his wife and children. He said, "I will take you across the border." He opened the trunk, and all of our luggage fit into the trunk. Because having us there, and because I had to buy my visa at the border, it took an extra 3 hours before we did cross. He was very patient. He was very kind. We call him our Lithuanian angel, because I don't know how we would have gotten across the border or where we would have stayed that night, except for maybe going into a field and cozying up to some cows. Some people were supposed to be waiting for us because Michael Palche had written ahead and mentioned that we would be coming. We crossed the border into pitch blackness. There was no town really across the border. The town of Chop is only a spot where one crosses the border. And Romas said, "I will take you to Uzhgorod. There you can decide what you want to do the next day." Uzhgorod is the capital of Transcarpathia. And he took us to the hotel and we said, "Let us pay you." He says, "I don't want any money at all." I said, "Well, let us put you in a room for the night." He says, "No, I want to go home to my wife." He still had hundreds of miles to drive. We finally did give him some money, and he went on his way. The next day, we looked on the map and saw where we had to go to the village of Rokossova. That 60 miles, one train could cover in 6 hours. We thought, this is impossible. Things are really deteriorating as far as transportation is concerned. But we stopped near the train station and found somebody who would drive us there for $40, and we rejoiced. We went to the home, came to an address that Michael Palche gave. It was to one of his daughters still living in the village, Maria Romashevska. We came to her house, and she almost started crying. She was so happy to see us. She knew that somebody was coming from her father. And the first thing she says, sit down and eat. We wanted to talk about what we're going to be doing. We wanted to find out what's happening to us and to this whole experience. She says, you cannot talk until you eat. After we ate, she says, you must rest. So she put both of us in a bed where she and her husband slept. Then we came out, and in comes a man called Ivan Pavli. He comes in and said, Michael Palche has written to me that you are to stay in our home. So take your luggage, and we'll walk a certain distance, not too far, maybe 100 yards, to where he lived. And there we began to talk about who we were. We began to talk about Michael Palche and our meeting with him. We began to talk about our church, about our beliefs. Immediately I found a certain bond between us. Not everything was the same, but he was very anxious to talk about his beliefs, and John Carlson and I were very anxious to talk about our convictions and our beliefs. People started coming over to his small home. At one point, there were 40 people in a small room. I don't know how in the world they all squeezed in. There were people under the table, mostly children. There were people on the walls, too deep. They all wanted to find out who these Americans were that came from Michael Palche, the Americans that Michael Palche had sent back to Ukraine. There we met the people that we have now developed a very strong bond and relationship with. First of all, Viktor Pavli. He is the founder, the head of Mission Nazareth. It's a humanitarian mission. One of the first things the Sabbatarians did after becoming free of religious restrictions by the government was to establish a mission to help those who are less fortunate. Now, these are people who earned $30 to $50 a month. And they, as their first deed, established a humanitarian, a charitable mission to help those who were poorer than they were. I said, who are these people? They said, Moldovans. They are just going through a civil war which involved Russia, where thousands of people were killed in massacre style, not seen since World War II in that part of the world. Whole villages were buried under. The Russians had brought in a peacekeeping force, which is an oxymoron. You don't have a Russian peacekeeping force, because the only way they brought peace was to kill a lot of people and shut people up. They were sending food, money, glass for fixing the homes of brethren who had their homes destroyed. The mission was hard at work. Viktor Pavli told me that the purpose of the mission was to help those who were poor, and also to evangelize and to distribute literature that they had, which was very little, and it was not even their own literature. The Sabbatarian churches gave their support to Mission Nazareth. Now today, Mission Nazareth has grown quite a bit since that time. They've moved into a new facility, very similar to this building here, to this theater. The city has given Mission Nazareth an old movie theater, which before the coming of the Russians was a Jewish synagogue. And now they have it. They have an office. They're legally registered with the government. And it's an organization that we can work with legally and totally above board in Ukraine. In fact, when we did any of our projects, it was always done through Mission Nazareth. They are the ones who officially did the invitations to bring our people over, and the ones who were supposedly legally responsible for the care of our people. The next person we met was Vasil Mondich. Vasil Mondich was the second in charge of the Christians of the Sabbath Day. That is their official title, Christians of the Sabbath Day. He told me that they had 14 regions in the world, and Transcarpathia was the largest gathering of Sabbatarians anywhere. But they had a region in the Caucasus, in Ukraine, east of the Caucasus, or Carpathians, I should say, in Russia, Poland, Germany, that small group of 25 to 30 people that I had mentioned to you earlier, Tajikistan in Central Asia, Siberia, and other places. I said, who is the leader of the Sabbatarians? He said, a gentleman by the name of Frans Claussen. Frans Claussen, he's a man of Dutch descent who lives in Dushanbe, Tajikistan. He said, we have not talked to each other in over 6 months because communications are impossible between Tajikistan and Transcarpathia. But Vasily Mondich, who is a pastor and the one who is in second in charge of the Sabbatarians, is the person who said, I would like you to come to my home tonight as well. Of course, we were being tugged and pulled by a number of people. But we did go to his home that night, and as we came to his house about 10 p.m., his wife prepared a complete dinner for us. And of course, we had just eaten dinner about 3 hours before, but that's no problem. You must always eat. And there we talked until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning about our beliefs, about who we were. He was distantly related to Michael Palche himself. He wanted to know everything about us, and we wanted to know everything about him. Their hospitality was unbelievable. They opened up their home to us. The next 2 days were spent in getting to know more people and other pastors in the area. Some of them keep the holy days. Some do not. Some keep the Passover at the beginning of the 14th day of the first month. Some keep it at the end of the 14th day. What was interesting is that they were able to get along in spite of certain doctrinal differences. At Sabbath services, they wanted us to be sure to go to services in Rokossovo, in the very beautiful new building they built. In fact, it had never been used. It was still not completely finished. But they said they wanted to hold a service there because we had come from Michael Palche. They said that Michael Palche had asked God's blessing upon the ground upon which that church was built. And it was built as a joint venture between the Pentecostals, who worship there on Sundays, and the Sabbatarians, who worship there on the Sabbath. They had a very friendly relationship, amazing relationship, where they were able to construct a church building with two groups of quite different beliefs. We had a Friday night service. We had a Sabbath service on Sabbath morning, a Sabbath service Sabbath afternoon. A total of 6 hours of meetings on the Sabbath. And after that, they had a board meeting, would you believe, after the last final service. They had a board meeting once a month. Actually, very similar in structure, governmentally and congregationally, as what we have here. John Carlson and I both spoke. We spoke Friday night. We also spoke on the Sabbath. On Friday night, some of the Pentecostals actually came over, too, to hear what we had to say, including the pastor of the Pentecostal church. I told him about our beliefs, about Michael Palche. When I mentioned his name, people began to openly weep because they had known and loved him. They felt they could always come to his home and always talk to him. His home was 2 doors down from where Ivan Pavli lived. It's an abandoned home right now in the village of Rokossovo. My sermon was about the holy days, about why we keep the holy days and why they are important to us. John Carlson spoke about mutual respect one for another. And then Ivan Pavli, he is not a minister or even a deacon, he does not wish to be, but he's the leading lay member in the village, gave a message. He said, we have been praying for 10 years to find people like ourselves. People in our village are even laughing at us because they're telling us there is nobody else like you who believes like you. They said, we've been praying for 10 years, and now we have had our prayers answered this day to see you, to see the beliefs you have, and the spirit that you have as being one with theirs. He talked about how Elijah felt that he was so alone in doing his work, and he lamented to God that, I am alone. I'm tired. I'm the only one doing the work of God for you. And God said, sit down, Elijah, I have news for you. There are 7,000 others who have not bowed down to Baal. And he said, Ivan Pavli said, today we have also found the 7,000, the others who have not bowed down their knee to Baal. John Carlson and I looked at each other when we heard this, and we said to ourselves, or to one another, I thought we had found the 7,000. And they say they have found the 7,000. Interesting perspective of how people see things. This was our first trip, November of 1992. It would be another year before I would return to Transcarpathia. This time, I brought my wife with me, and Ole Zajac, a very good friend of mine, who works in the legal department at the Worldwide Church of God, who speaks fluent Ukrainian. This time we brought over some literature that we had translated, not us personally, but we had translated into Ukrainian and Russian. We had two booklets translated. One was God's Holy Days, and the other one was Why Were You Born? We presented these booklets to them. Now also, the year before, we brought over a number of booklets that had been translated back by the Worldwide Church of God from the early 1960s. Booklets such as, Which Day is the Sabbath of the New Testament? What Kind of Faith is Required for Salvation? And other titles. When we came back this time, the Sabbatarians told us that what they had read in Mr. Armstrong's writings rang clear and true. They said that this man, Herbert Armstrong, is a person who had very special insight. He was able to take a subject, such as faith, and make it extremely clear. He was able to explain the Sabbath very clearly. Now, between the time that we were there, in 1992 and 1993, a group of these Sabbatarians had launched a trip to Siberia. One of the Sabbatarians had lived in the Altai region, just north of Kazakhstan, in the southern part of Siberia, and wanted to go back. He said, that's one of the most godless areas of the world. The people there have absolutely no concept of a God, the future. They are just steeped in their alcohol. He said, I want to go back there and do some evangelism. So he set off with three broken down cars. At least they looked broken down, but they had to travel 5,000 miles one way to Siberia. And he brought with him the booklets that we had brought with us. We brought about 5-6 copies of each of the booklets. And when they were doing their evangelizing, which involved singing and preaching, one of the people who came to the meetings in Altai, Siberia, was a woman who worked for the newspaper. She took one of the booklets to work and set it to type and reprinted over 1,000 copies of it and distributed. I think it was 1,000 copies, if I may be mistaken about that number. It was somewhere between 500, I've heard, and 1,000. That booklet did its work, and they feel it was instrumental in helping establish a church of about 30-plus people in Siberia. Now, these people were also there in 1993, the ones who did the evangelizing, and we saw them because they told us a story. And when we showed them the booklet, Why Were You Born?, they said, this is excellent material for evangelizing. This booklet answers some very important questions. And those booklets have all been given out, all the boxes of booklets that we had given out about the Holy Days and Why Were You Born? Have been completely distributed there. Economic conditions were terrible when my wife and I visited in 1993. Inflation was 30% a month. Wages, again, about $30 to $50 a month. Unemployment in the area ran at 70%. and there was no future. The only ones who made any money or got ahead were people who were able to get out of the country and go to Czechoslovakia to pick tomatoes, or go to Hungary or to Germany to work in construction. But the area is extremely depressed economically. This last time that I had visited, now when I was there in 1993, the dollar was worth 250 Ukrainian kupons. That's their currency, it's called the kupon. When I visited there last month, the kupon was worth, or the dollar was worth, 192,000 kupons. A million coupon note, we considered a $5 bill. On this 1993 trip, we talked about establishing the Ambassador College project and how to bring students over for the purpose of establishing a presence to teach English, to develop a relationship, a tighter relationship with the Sabbatarians. And we spent, this was our longest visit, this was a 10-day to 2-week visit that we took in 1993. We talked with school teachers, we talked with the director of education, we talked to the mayor, we had many, many contacts with people at that time. But we did lay the groundwork for bringing Ambassador College students over the next year. Also on this trip, we had brought over, not literally with us, but part of a shipment, Bibles, large print Russian Bibles, which they loved. They absolutely were excited about the Russian Bibles. We also had brought in 3 sewing machines, and some of the churches around the country had brought in fabric and used clothing, and even brethren in Hong Kong had made a shipment of boots for the Sabbatarians. We discussed a plan for working together, a plan which involved the translation of literature that we had, a plan of how to bring in humanitarian aid. And the first thing that crossed the minds of the Sabbatarians regarding the humanitarian aid was, we're not going to take it for ourselves. We are going to distribute it according to the needs in our community through Mission Nazareth. And even this last time that I had visited with them, and we had one of our churches, the church in Boston, send $1,275 to them this last winter. They said, we use that money to help the most destitute of families. One was a family of 10. That was freezing and hungry this last winter, that needed help, among several other families. We also discussed in the future doing public lectures. But that was our 3-point plan: the translation of literature, humanitarian aid, and doing public lecture sometime in the future. Trip number 3. This is with Beverly in the spring of 1994. We were already in Europe for a ministerial conference, and went from France, where the conference was held, on to Ukraine. We brought with us seed that was provided by our pastor in Dayton, Ohio. We had a huge box of seed, of beans, peas, corn, and buckwheat. We also did the final arrangements for the project for the summer, actually saw the house that the students would be living in, and talked to the teacher of the, or the director of the school, and the English department at the school where the teaching would take place. We also took soil samples from that area and brought it back for analysis. Then our 4th trip was in July of 1994, and we brought with us a cameraman, Dwayne Abler, who videotaped what was happening with the project and what the students were doing. We felt this was the high point of our relationship. We discussed very, very enthusiastically about working together and working with Mission Nazareth. Now, it's interesting that in the entire process of working and talking with them and the deep friendship that we had, never was there any talk about becoming one organization. Never was there any talk about one organization coming under the other. And that was interesting. We felt a certain sense of decency about the fact that we have certain similar beliefs, but we're from 2 different sides of the world. We're from 2 different cultures. We're from 2 different ways of thinking. And it's probably best that we stay separate. We always talked about how we could work together, but never how we could become one organization. We didn't want that. I don't think they wanted that either. As one of the Sabbatarian leaders told me, let's work together. There are enough sinners out there for both of us. After this, there was almost a 2-year break before I went back to visit this last month. I didn't know if I'd ever return because of the disruption that's taken place in our life and church. I didn't know if I'd ever come back. But it did work out. It all began with me meeting a gentleman at the Feast of Tabernacles in England, Morris Frone. Morris Frone is the surgeon. He's also an elder in the United Church of God. He had just been convicted in his thinking about doing some humanitarian work after reading about the children of Chernobyl. And he wanted to lend his expertise to what he could do to help. What was interesting to him was that there had been a very sudden rise in thyroid cancer in teenage children, those who were radiated immediately after the Chernobyl accident. The rates of thyroid cancer are 8-fold over what is normal. We were at a dinner.
Like I have just cut my ties with, that I did not want to cut ties with, that I would like to rebuild the relationship with. And so we talked through the dinner about possibly going over. Of course, it seemed a little bit far-fetched. We'd already in England, we'd come back to the United States. How do we get there? The cost of all this, etc. How do we do it? He didn't know, and I didn't know. At the Cincinnati conference, which was held the first week of December, he brought over some information about the hospitals in the Chernihiv area, which is 40 miles from Chernobyl, and talked about people that were willing to invite him and that he could work with. I told him, too, that I had talked to the Sabbatarians and was wondering if he'd be interested in going with me to visit there as well. And so everything worked out to where we did go this last April to visit. I spoke to you a couple of weeks ago about the Chernihiv part, so I won't go through that part, but we traveled from there to Transcarpathia by car, which took parts of 3 days. We were welcomed with wide open arms by our Sabbatarian friends. It was a reunion with tears, with happiness, with a sense of friendship that ran very deep. As always, we were welcomed with prayer. Immediately, we couldn't wait to come into our home and kneel down and thank God for the fact that He had brought us back together. We were thankful that we were staying together as friends. We felt like this was something that was of God, that God had made certain that the investment that we had put into our contacts, our working together, our bringing things over, learning from them, was not something to be in vain, but something that would continue, and the relationship would continue. They also told me that a Sabbatarian minister had come all the way from South America to visit them a few months previously, or last fall. And the way he found out about the Sabbatarians was because my wife and I had gone down there in July of 1994 and showed a Ukrainian Sabbatarian church a video of the Sabbatarians in Ukraine. And some of these people said, we want to go back. Some of these people had left Ukraine in 1938, a long time ago. And one of the ministers, who had been an immigrant from 1938, had actually gone back after seeing the video. We gave him the address of Vasily Bondich. He wrote to him, he corresponded with him, and he went back to visit. But there are many hundreds of Ukrainian Sabbatarians in northern Argentina. In any event, we caught up on where we had left off. We had a lot to catch up on. They were proud of the fact that their mission had taken new quarters. It had a new office. They showed us the things that we had left behind as part of our project. We left them 3 computers, 1 desktop and 2 smaller portable computers, We had left them with a few copy machines. It was good to see those things being put to good use in the mission. They had a little glass cabinet with literature that they had from us, that they were very appreciative of from the past. The church had tripled in size, as I mentioned, in Hoost itself. In Rokossovo, in the village, it stayed about the same. But the church is growing in other places in the area. Whenever we go there, we have to register with the KGB. The KGB is always aware of our presence there, and anybody who speaks publicly has to register with the police and with internal security. It's more and more difficult to come to Ukraine. It's more difficult to just come into a village on your own and spend time with people. Here's what's happened. Ever since freedom and independence has come to Ukraine, they opened their doors wide open to the West. And many people came to look. Many people came to evangelize. Many people came to preach. But they left very little there. Some came to promise help to hospitals, to children. And they would see what the people were enduring. They would leave, never to be heard from again. And both the Sabbatarians and the people at the hospitals told us that this was very discouraging to them, as they were much more picky about who they were inviting over to even look around. They were not here for show. We are real people. And you're in that land, in Ukraine, whether it be in Transcarpathia or in Greater Ukraine, which is the eastern side of the mountains. And you look at some of the richest land in the world. 30% of the world's topsoil is in Ukraine. The sky, the land is beautiful and unpolluted, relatively speaking. And you wonder, why can't these people live like we do over here? Why are these people only making $30, $40, $50 a month? And right now, the people in Ukraine have not been paid, anybody who works for the government, which includes all hospitals, all teachers, all communications workers, they have not been paid since the 1st of January because the government is bankrupt. But they dare not stop working because they may lose their job. It's pathetic what's taking place. The country is going through some of the very worst conditions that it ever has, and the Sabbatarians are right in the middle of it. We talked for a long time about mutual interests. I showed them the Constitution and bylaws of the United Church of God. I went through our 20 statements of belief, foundations of belief that we have as Article 2 of our Constitution. I showed them the literature that we had produced, the three good news magazines. I paged through them page by page and explained what each article was about. I showed them our three booklets. And one thing that really struck me, we have done quite a bit in the past year. Sometimes we feel that we're awfully pokey and slow about producing new literature, and we have to get our church up and running all at once. But I was amazed as to what we had actually done the past year. Plus, I showed them about three or four issues of New Beginnings. I told them about the churches. I told them we had nearly 15,000 members in the United States attending services every Sabbath. They rejoiced. They were thankful. They said, praise God for what's happened. At one point, we were explaining some of what we had gone through to stand up for our beliefs. And we had a whole table full of gentlemen that stood up and congratulated Morris Frohn and myself. It was a little bit embarrassing, but these people rejoiced with us. They said, this is what we have had to go through ourselves to stand up for our faith. We discussed what we would work on together as far as translation was concerned. As we paged through the Good News magazine, I said, what types of articles do you think would be most useful to you? They liked the Bible studies. They liked the article about, was the law known before Mount Sinai? Were the Ten Commandments known before Mount Sinai? We like the format. We like the Bible study format, questions, answer, discussion. That we're not used to techniques such as this. So that's the very first one that will be translated. And actually will be translated by translators that they have. They like the story of Abraham and Sarah, which were in two successive issues of the Good News magazine. They appreciated the Bible study about repentance.
We showed them the booklet about the Sabbath, and I paged through that page by page and explained to them where the booklet was going, such as the chapter about Christ and the Sabbath. I showed them the techniques we used of cutouts and boxes to have supplementary material brought into the reading stream as somebody is reading the booklet. They said, this is a tremendous aid, a tremendous tool. We would certainly like to have this booklet translated. And we have started that process this past week in Stanford University. One of the translators there, who is skilled in religious type of translation, will start working on chapter one of that booklet. And then we want to read it and see if it rings true, and maybe even send it to the Sabbatarians by fax and see what they feel about the translation, and hopefully get that booklet translated by July. And maybe it'll be produced, or maybe it will be sent as a booklet that will look like the other booklets we have on the Sabbath. So far it's only in English. Or maybe we will have it in a less expensive paper format, 8.5 by 11 sheets for starters, later to be produced as a full-fledged booklet. We discussed their needs. We discussed the things that they wanted to have. One of the things that was most interesting in this discussion with the Sabbatarians was that they were very honest about things that they really need, and were very open about things they don't need. They said, we really appreciate the heart of everyone who wants to contribute and to help us. But we also want to tell you that there are some things that we don't need, and there are certain things that are exotic that we don't have to have. If we could work together on you bringing over the exact things that we need. Now, we had shipped over to them 300 or 500 Bibles in Ukrainian, thinking that these people are Ukrainian. They will enjoy having a Ukrainian Bible. We also shipped over 100 large print Russian Bibles. This was 2 years ago. And I know that they raved and raved about the Russian Bibles. They said, this was a real treasure for our pastors. We gave all the pastors one large print Russian Bible. So this is a real treasure. This is something that is a very valuable gift to us. But they said nothing about the Ukrainian Bibles. I finally asked them this time, I said, well, what about the Ukrainian Bibles? Did you ever use them? They said, you know, those Bibles were printed in the United States. It was an American-Ukrainian translation. Our people just simply didn't like it. It wasn't very good. They're very open and very honest. They said, our people, while they are Ukrainian, while Ukrainian is spoken on the streets, the people worship God in Russian. And they said, we would appreciate even literature to be translated primarily into Russian, and if you can, into Ukrainian. So we got through that. We get to understand some of their specific needs of how they need to have things done. Also, they said, I know that some of your people want to bring goods from the West. But they said, it's very wasteful in shipping to bring things all the way from the United States or Canada to be brought here at great expense. They were commenting about how they had a certain product shipped to them, food product, that they could have bought in Hungary for one-third to one-half the cost, and could have gotten twice as much of it if they had the money. They said, if we could work together where we tell you exactly what's needed and how we can get it, we just need the means to be able to get some of these things. Now, one thing the Sabbatarians have done is that they have acquired or renting or something a trailer, a 40-foot trailer. It's actually 12 meters long, which is close to 40 feet long. They said, we can have this brought to Hungary and to Germany, and we can load up on all kinds of things that our people would need, from food to clothing to even washing machines, things that we just simply don't have in our city or are very difficult to acquire in our city. And a lot of these things are donated by other relief agencies. All we need is the diesel fuel, the ability to hire a few drivers, and maybe some money to buy some of the items. I said, how much would that cost? They said, oh, about $3,800 per load. If we could have one or two loads like that financed by brethren from the West, they said that would be a wonderful and very cost-effective way of helping our people. Because they could load up an entire semi-trailer load of humanitarian items to help them with their needs. So we had a very honest discussion about what those people would need and how we could work together. We also worked with Mission Nazareth on how we could bring things over and how we could simplify things in transferring funds, in helping them. Mission Nazareth also said that they would be willing to help work with the hospitals and pharmacies in the area to bring in necessary medication for people who needed it, because they would make sure that it would come to the people and go to the people who need it. Oftentimes, humanitarian aid, if it's sent to some obscure address, such as a hospital, is pilfered and stolen, sometimes even by doctors themselves. But they said through the mission, they could make sure that those things are delivered to where they should be. In fact, one of the good friends of the Sabbatarians was the head of all the pharmacology in the county. And he came and met us and said that if you want to work together this way, I said, we can work with the Sabbatarians. So it was good to see people all working together and building these connections and networking in this way. The Sabbatarians also wanted to have more direct contact with other Sabbatarians in other parts of the world. And three of the families said that we will make sure that letters that are sent to us in English are translated and letters that we write are translated back. In fact, we have one person in our congregation here who is writing to one of the families, and we have one family in the Lafayette Church who is writing to another one of the families. Michael Palche, the very wise gentleman who lives now in the United States, when I had talked to him and told him about my trips and going over, he told me that we want to learn from you. But I hope, he said, that you could also learn from us. I'll have to say that I have learned a lot from the Sabbatarians. I find myself falling short as a Christian when I see the kind of work and what they do with how little they have. It puts me to shame. When I see the type of opportunities and the means that we have, and to see in comparison what they don't have and what they are able to do. I have learned a lot from them in observing them, in talking to them. I have learned a lot about how God works. These people are converted, the ones that I'm working with. In fact, I admire their character, and I wish in some ways that I could have the kind of character that they do. What I've learned from them are the following points. I'll conclude with this. I have seen God doing a work where He wants to do a work. I see these people as having been called of God and committed to a way of life. I see these people loving the Sabbath, loving the law of God. And just as we sang today, "Oh, how I love thy law," these people love the law of God. The Ten Commandments are placed in a very open, obvious spot in the congregation for people to be reminded of God's supreme and beautiful law that governs relationships. It was a joy to see these people's commitment to Jesus Christ. As these people are baptized by water immersion, formerly having been atheists, they said of a pastor's conference that they held, there were 103 pastors. 100 of these pastors had come from atheism, of no religion at all. 3 had come from the Orthodox Church. But it's wonderful to see what God does when He wants to do it, and how He's changed the lives of these people who had no God in their lives. Sometimes I wonder if that's almost easier than to have to come from error. I've seen these churches that have grown from small groups, and some of them still meet in homes, to some churches which are quite large. The church of Rokossovo is 200, maybe more. Church in Kushnitsa, down the road about 30 miles, which is, they say, about 300 people or so. Altogether, there are 3,000 Sabbatarians in Transcarpathia. It's wonderful to see these people honor their children the way they do. honor their teenagers. They have two services on the Sabbath, plus a Friday night Bible study. The afternoon service is devoted to children and teenagers, where the children and teenagers take part, sometimes even giving a message. In the afternoon service that we were in, there was a strong message given to the influences of the world on our teenagers. I thought to myself, this country, this nation is so innocent. The things that we have in the West and the influences we have in the West would destroy these people. Except that I don't think these people would fall for a decadent way of life. From visit to visit, these people would tell us about new people now that had become believers, that had come from a way of life that was godless to a way of worshiping God. It was wonderful to see that type of growth. These are people who are committed to a way of life. They always want to know, what is the will of God? What would God want me to do? And you see their love to do God's will in how they keep the Sabbath day, how they worship God, how they fellowship, how they sing praises. And their music is absolutely beautiful. The harmony, the rhythm, the words, the melody. They read the Bible. It's an important part of the service. A part of the service is devoted to reading Scripture. Seeing the way that the youth are involved is also very heartening. Also, seeing them prepare for the Sabbath. When you're there on a Friday, you see a different tone set by that day as you see the ironing of dresses and clothes for the Sabbath day. You see food being prepared to be eaten on the Sabbath day. You see these people's attention devoted towards the high point of the week, when they will fellowship and get together and praise and honor and remember their Creator and their God. When the Sabbath would come, and being in a Sabbatarian's home, they said, it's time to kneel down and pray. It is the Sabbath. And here you kneel down and pray with these people who have the hardships they do. And hearing them thank God for their health, for their life, for their food, for all the things that God has given them. And I think of how much we have and how little in comparison we thank God for the things that He has given us. We see these people who have a very strong desire to talk about and to live by every word of God. We see a willingness to learn and to grow in understanding. When we would talk about subjects such as the holy days, for example, that we observe that they do not, they said, we want to know more about these things. We want to understand more about the laws or the days that are observed in addition to the Sabbath day in Leviticus 23. And I told them that in Leviticus 23, the very first festival mentioned is the Sabbath. And it talks about the Passover. I said, why do you stop there? Why don't you continue on and see the other days that God had set in motion to be observed? They said, good point. Something for us to think about. And the Sabbatarians in the village of Rokossova told me this last time, we are coming closer to you in understanding the holy days. Which also brought up a point to me, we have to be patient with people. Who knows, maybe some of them will never accept them. But that's not why I was there. I was there to learn, to develop a relationship, and to be able to talk about these things. I saw how these people survived in services, in small groups, in churches, in homes. Nothing stopped them from doing what they had to do. These are people who recognize that they were living in an oppressed country, but God had opened up their minds to His truth, and it was their responsibility to obey God, knowing that He would not lay a burden upon them that was too difficult, that He would provide a way for them to worship Him. Evangelism, spreading the gospel, preaching the gospel, is a way of life with these people. They recognize that it is the commission and the duty of all of the churches to continue to preach the gospel. through public proclamation, and they were doing that publicly. The church at Hoest for a few years had a morning service on the Sabbath, but in the afternoon they had an outdoor service where everyone was invited to attend. They feel like it's their duty and their responsibility. Like the group of 12 people who went to Siberia to evangelize. The next year they took four vans with them. I think it was three or four vans. And took the same route. It's got to be one of the dirtiest, longest rides in the world. Driving from almost the Hungarian border to China by automobile. For the purpose of evangelizing. Of not knowing where you'll stop. Doing it on virtually no income. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. It's a way of life with these people. As Pastor Mondich and I were about to walk into services, this was on a previous trip, here was a lady just outside of the church hall with a broom sweeping away. And he tells her, "You know, we have a visitor from the United States today. Why don't you put your broom down, come on in, and listen to our speaker from the United States?" And she smiled at him and kept on sweeping. About 10 or 15 minutes into the services, she walks in and sits down and listens to the entire service. The point was, they were not afraid to invite people. They're not afraid to include people. They're not afraid to be proud in the proper sense of what they stood for, what they believed, and what they wanted to share. They are very happy with the prospect that they are going to people that have never been part of any church, but they are coming out of the godless, atheistic, communist system that has wiped out 2-3 generations of people. And they can be preaching Jesus Christ and his way of life. They set a very high personal example. They don't drink. They don't smoke. They feel like their society has been so plagued by drunkenness that they want to set a sterling example of not drinking. Because for the Russians in particular, who live in the city, there's only one reason to drink, and that is to get drunk. They set a very high example. When Beverly and I were there 2 years ago, we were there just after the Greek Orthodox Easter. And we were to meet with school officials and other people to set up our project. But we couldn't do anything for 2 days, until 2 days after Easter, because people were so drunk and answered the telephone so foolishly. The Sabbatarians were so embarrassed for their community, but they said, "Easter is an excuse for these people to get drunk." They said, "We must set the very highest example. We must be lights. We must be the salt of the earth." Their family values, their family life, is an example to behold. When we went out to the river to have a picnic, and after we had eaten, it was so natural for them to sit up and sing songs of praise to God. There's a very earnest desire on the part of these people to preach the Word of God to a society that has been cut off from God. And right now, Viktor Pavli, the head of the mission, told me there's a new danger. He said that now it's becoming fashionable to attend church. The Orthodox and the Catholic Church. People go there for show. And they said it's so hard to reach these people now because they already think that they are going to church. They already think that they are Christians somehow, but they go only for show. Also learned something about humanitarian aid, which I had already made mention of, but repeat a few things. We need to learn how to help people with what they really need, not what we want to give them or what we think they need, but to be honest with them. We spent hours talking about how we could help out in a humanitarian way. In some ways, the things that they want most is contact with us and literature, which is already in process of being translated. But also, as far as other items, they said, please discuss with us what some of the needs are. Give us something that we can make something with. They were very pleased with the sewing machines that we had brought over. But they say, we also have to have the whole stream of items that go with the sewing machines. We need fabric, we need zippers, we need elastic, we need everything that goes in, that's involved in the process. Otherwise, the sewing machines will be sitting idly by. As many factories in Ukraine are closed, shut down, because there is no raw materials. Or there's some part that's missing and the entire factory is shut down. They said, we have a saying in our country, when we have cereal, we don't have milk. When we have milk, we don't have cereal. Shows that they don't have things all together the way they should. And yet these people are very industrious. These are hardworking people with very strong values for work. They're not lazy, but it's the economic system that has brought about such a tragic state of affairs economically. They need our know-how. The area is so beautiful. Morris Frohn, when visiting with me, he said, what a wonderful place for somebody to bring in and export food from. There are walnut trees. There are beautiful grapes, mushrooms, world-renowned, that are grown in Transcarpathia. If people could just be able to work with these people and to have them sell produce to the West, it would enhance everybody's life. I also learned that these people don't need Western culture. We were not there to bring the U.S. to them, or to bring them out of their country to another land, as though that'll solve the problem. The solution to the problem is to help them help themselves, and to help them be able to be productive, and have a sense of well-being and a sense of dignity about themselves. I have been traveling now, and I have been to the Soviet Union, Russia, Ukraine, probably 10, 11, maybe 12 times now since 1986, 85, no, 86. It's always the same story about the lacks, about what they don't have. And I'm coming to a point personally where I would like to make a difference in the lives of some people and to help these people with what they don't have. And we're beginning to take steps in doing that. The final thing that I learned from them was how they pray. Prayer is so important to them. Prayer is their connection and their power and their spiritual relationship with God. We prayed before we sat down to eat. We always prayed standing up. We prayed after finishing a meal. We prayed even in our business meetings when we sat down and talked about how we would relate and what articles we would translate. Vasily Mondich or Victor Pavlovich said, let's pray about this. We'd pray right there on the spot. When we'd meet, we'd pray. And when we left, we all got in a big circle and prayed and thanked God for a visit and prayed that it wouldn't be too long before we'd see each other again. To these people, prayer was their connection and a reality of their relationship with God. It was done in such a way that spontaneous, caring, automatic, necessary was part of their life. It was so biblical. There was always a readiness instead of a reluctance to pray. Public prayer in church was a very powerful vehicle, especially at one point where we prayed for a man who had leukemia and small children. It was a very fervent prayer given in church. Yes, Michael Palche said, we want to learn from you. And yes, they do want to learn from us. Some of the things that they do want to learn from us is how to organize a church, because their organizational skills are very lacking. Their business skills are very lacking. They would like to be able to educate their ministry. They would like to educate their ministry in more things regarding the Bible, because they basically have an uneducated ministry. They would like to be able to get materials from us. They would like to have literature available for their people. But also they said, I hope that you will learn from us, and believe me, I have learned a lot from them. I feel at this point I'm the one who's benefited rather than them from us. I do want to write more about the Sabbatarians. I do have a website on the internet that I will have regular updates of our working with the Sabbatarians, including, hopefully in the next month or so, some pictures and photographs that I want to place of the Sabbatarian families and what we had seen. I'd like to feel comfortable in communicating with as many as I could, or those who are interested, in how we could help the Sabbatarians and how we could work with them. I have a internet website, and I will give the address for it for those who would like to check it, and you could communicate to me through that. The address is http://ourworld, that's OURWORLD, .compuserve.com/homepages/CubicV. Perhaps this could be posted. Also, it can be seen at CompuServe, and my address there is 71251, 1271. That's 71251, 1271. I also have one more internet address through the United Church of God, which is Victor_Cubic, that's VICTOR, then the underline symbol, KUBIK, @UCG.org. I certainly hope that this conference is valuable to help all of us learn from one another and bring us more together. I know this, is that what I have learned from the Sabbatarians is something that I will remember and practice and live with for the rest of my life.